And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
I'm Jeremy Heide.
I'm Neil from Bowie.
And I'm Edmund from Greenville, and I've finally slipped Agent Six, I think.
He will come back when you least expect it.
You think? That needs explaining.
Unless this is all an illusion he's placed in my head, but hopefully we'll find out by the end of the episode.
Well, I think you're really, yeah. Are you a butterfly dreaming you're a man? Or are you a telepath dreaming you're a mundane?
He doesn't know.
All right. No.
He's been silenced.
I think you just hit the mind block.
Uh-oh. So that means he's sitting unconscious on a rail train going nowhere.
Yeah.
Semi-conscious. Oh, the inside jokes just keep coming. Anyway, yeah, today's show is going to be about the short stories, which I'm not sure if a lot of people have managed to get all of them over the years, but we'll, you know, it'll be a nice survey to take. And we're slightly light on opening news, but today is Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Arrgh.
And I believe Tim had some interesting... What were you doing? No, it was Star Wars and Babylon 5 mashups that had us going before the show. That was still funny. And Jason is saying that Endeavor took off on its final flight today.
Yes, it was mated to its plane. I think the flight was delayed because of the weather that came through the East Coast here. But now Endeavor is on its way to its final resting place down in California. And on sort of related news, the super secret X-37B mini space plane that Boeing has developed for both NASA and the United States Air Force is getting ready for a potential second flight in October. And what it's going to be doing in orbit, we don't know. They're not telling us.
And?
Just saying.
Well, that means that you know what they're going to be doing. You're just not telling us.
No, I don't know what they're going to be doing.
Sure you do.
I don't.
Okay, fine.
You can have Edmund scan me if you want. There, you won't find anything.
Nothing at all.
Yeah, right. Literally, nothing at all.
It's just an empty slate. You know, we really should re-record some Babylon 5 quotes in pirate talk one of these days. Just because that would be funny.
That would be... I'm just trying to think of a... Arr, it be too late for the pebbles to vote.
What is that phrase the earthlings use? Yes, nibbled to death by cats. Yeah. That's bad. We shouldn't do that anymore.
You know, the Vorlons have a saying. Understanding's a three-edged sword, but we humans have another one. Put your gold doubloons where your mouth is.
Oh, the awfulness. The awfulness. But hey, it's all in good fun.
Who am
right?
I be Sunanaba.
No. Don't do that one. Because that one will burn into my brain and I won't have any way to get it out.
You know, there be only one human captain what faced him in Bari and survived. He be behind me. You be in front of me. If ye value your lives, be somewhere else.
You're
the
corp,
mother
me...
of the corp.
You're going to make me regret I said that, aren't you? Oh, I predict a train wreck.
We call that a theme.
No, that's a train wreck. That's all train wreck all the time. All right.
Be gone, you varmints, out of me universe.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a really quick break and come back with short story discussions.
If you have your lives, be some use.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you, wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa, the first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award, with weekly stories from the world's best authors, Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more, with news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
And we're talking about the six short stories. Yes, for the longest time I thought there was only four. I actually had all six. I just didn't know it until a couple years ago. We have three stories that are in Amazing Stories magazine. The first is Shadow of His Thoughts. The second was Genius Loci. And the third, Space, Time, and the Incurable Romantic. Now, all three of those were written by JMS.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they only did one in the B5 magazine.
Right. And I'm trying to get my notes here because my notes blew across the table.
So he wrote Hidden Agendas in B5 magazine 22. Then Fiona Avery did True Seeker in 23. And then J. Gregory Keyes did the Nautilus Coil in the 24, which was the final issue of the magazine.
Right. Now, to your knowledge, which ones were easier for people to find, the Amazing Stories magazines or the B5 magazines?
Well, I can't speak to that because I never found any of them.
Yeah, I mean, I was regularly getting the B5 magazines at the time, so I got those. I didn't get the Amazing Stories magazine. Zines at the time, and I just have PDFs of those, which are lurking around in various places.
Because I was the same as most B5 fans. I got the B5 magazines as they were coming out, at least the U.S. edition. The U.S. edition I saw, I think I noticed it on the book stand, like the magazine racks. Starting with like issue 5, and that at a convention I managed to find issues 1 through 4, and that's when I discovered that there were 9 UK editions before the first US editions, and that same dealer happened to have most of those, and so I just got those from him too. But after that, I was able to find the B5 magazine at, you know, on the magazine rack at either Borders or Barnes & Noble. I just, like, walked in and grabbed them like you see, like, the Buffy or the Supernatural or the Star Wars magazines today. The B5 magazine was right there, and some of them, depending on the cover, would sell out.
Yeah, I mean, I just ordered them with my monthly box of comics.
And I had stopped collecting comics by then, so that wasn't happening. But I didn't know about the Amazing Stories until the very last one, because I saw Marcus and Susan on the cover of it on the newsstand near the Babylon 5 magazine. I went, huh, what? And I grabbed it, and I was like, huh, there's more stories. And I never found the other two until I think I found the Genius Loci info on, what is that, Amazing Stories 600. I think I found that one on eBay. And the very last one someone actually sent me right after we started doing the podcast. But I would like to find out, like, how many people, which ones were easier for people to find if they found them when they came out and hung on to them. You know, I'm just curious how many people went looking for them when they realized they exist.
That sounds like a feedback loop question for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people were thinking that they'd, you know, soon be collected, but we're waiting for a collection of those stories and the many more that were going to be written. And
that would be nice.
Well, I recall digging through and as I was Googling some information, I ended up with an entry on the JMS News Archives, and I'm sure somebody will straighten me out that I read this wrong, but somebody had posted the question, you know, will these stories be collected or is it too short? And the response back from JMS, if I recall correctly, was that they were looking to try to get some more stories written by people like Neil Gaiman and a couple others, but that it just kind of fell through. You know, by the time they tried to get everything in place to get it done, the publisher had lost interest or something. I don't recall, but I think there was an attempt.
Yeah, and well, he did say this was 2001, January 17th, 2001. Somebody, said, with the demise on B5 magazine, Amazing Stories, wouldn't it make sense if all the Babylon 5 short stories that were published in both magazines could be put in one book that could be sold to the fans? And JMS says, we've mentioned it to Del Rey, but they haven't done anything about it.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I have to ask, does it have to go through Del Rey?
Well, I think probably at the time writing that in 2001, it did, given the
deal. That they were doing the other
but
stuff.
Now, at the moment, let's say JMS has enough influence to reach out and give Fiona Avery and Greg Keyes a call and say, hey, I'm making an electronic edition of the four short stories I wrote. You want in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he could put that collection of short stories, maybe any others that he might have hanging around that he never got around to publishing. You know, I'd buy an ebook of B5 short stories, you know, six stories, 10 stories. That'd be worth $5, $4.99.
And a lot of people would.
Several million B5 fans, many of them armed with iPads and Kindles and Nooks, would just go, give me now.
Yeah, I just saw the post that Tim was talking about JMS saying that, you know, I guess to properly put it together, you need another 3 to 4 stories. But
yeah.
So probably, you know, he was waiting for Del Rey to, you know, give a contract, and then he might have done that, but that didn't happen. So it's going to be some other way of doing that, and, you know, if they ever come out.
That was what I was going to say, is if it happens at all, and, well, that's a whole other story. So let's get into the stories themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah. Oh, and he, right. And another post. JMS does say someone would have to make the deal with WB. That's all. That's all that would be needed for it to be published. So that was in January 15th, 2003.
You know what? That's my new goal in life. My new goal in life is to win a $300 million lottery and ask Warner Brothers, say, hey, Give me all the rights to Babylon 5 except for the DVDs. Those you can have, you know.
Yeah.
All these rights are mine except Europa. You keep those and I'll take everything else and run with it.
All these worlds be yours.
Oh,
save God. Europa.
Okay. And my first act as new minister of the world would be to give Science Channel rerun rights to Babylon 5. Yay.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway. Yes, the very first one chronologically that came out, summer of 1999, Amazing Stories issue number 597 is Shadow of His Thoughts, a Londo story.
Just before he becomes prime minister.
Right. 6 days after Londo's coronation in Babylon 5, season 5.
Emperor. Yes, Emperor.
Yes.
So Emperor. He's got the Keeper.
Mm-hmm. Right. He has the Keeper, and the story focuses more on him making a choice about what actions he can and can't control. And involving it, they give a little bit of backstory and history on how the prophetesses, the Emperor's prophetesses, are chosen. And I thought that was a little interesting tidbit there.
Yeah, it was quite interesting there, and going off into meeting this young prophetess. Out in the wild there.
And it wasn't so much meeting her, it was she was able to see the truth of what was going on with him and him fighting the keeper saying, hey, she has to die. She knows about us, she has to die. And he's like, no, not happening.
No, but the thing is, this was a tradition with the Emperor. Would go out and meet
and,
the
meet the new one.
Right. But in this case, this was going to be a danger to her because of the Keeper. And so the plot of the story is him trying to save her. And so I thought it was interesting, and so he gets from his resolution of the story, he gets a little bit of peace with the Keeper, because it starts with him having this dream at the beginning, which has been upsetting him, and then once he's accomplished something, he doesn't have the dream anymore.
Yeah.
And how does it feel that it works in with what we see in the Centauri Prime trilogy? Does it feel like it's a good match, or does it feel like there's a contradiction in what JMS is writing in this story as opposed to what Peter David was writing? Or is it a non-issue altogether?
I think it's not really an issue. So it's just a slice in time right there, just a couple days, and it doesn't really intersect that much with what was going on in the Centauri Prime trilogy.
Gotcha. Summer, you were about to say something before I kind of talked over you.
I said it was. I liked how it sort of seemed to echo with Londo's actions. Remember, he sent Veer away to keep him away from the darkness that was around him, and it was sort of an echo of that, where he's protecting this young seer by making a decree that's completely false and sending her away, but restoring her family's house. And the woman who was trying to take advantage of her to get into court, Londo makes a deal with and says, you wanted to be in court and influence them? Come on up. He says, but I'm not a seer. So what? Who's going to know? just make your prophecies vague and, we'll just call it a day. And she's like, it would be nice if I could retire after 5 or 10 years with my own estate on it. And he's like, okay, no problem.
Yeah. Right.
And it is sort of echo the sort of sly casino deal making that we got used to seeing Londo make early on, while he's also protecting younger Centauri. That echoed kind of that rang true to Londo to me.
Right, because think back to that first year episode. It wasn't Born to the Purple, was it? We got the two young lovers trying to run off.
No, it wasn't Born to the Purple.
No, Born to the Purple was Adira.
With Adira, yeah. Oh, God. Adira. It's been so long now. It's been 7 years since I've seen that episode. But you know what I'm talking about. There's the two lovers, and they're avoiding they're running away from pre-arranged marriages, and Londo manages to find.
Jason says war prayer.
Yeah, that's what I believe is war prayer. Two star-crossed young Centauri.
Yep.
DC Fontana.
So it says, I hear what you're saying, Summer. It harkens back to that we've already seen in Londo. Any other further comments on Shadow of His Thoughts?
I think that covers most of it.
All right.
Yep.
Next story
in the lineup. Well, we're going to do all the Amazing Stories ones first. The next one is from issue 599 with the Leda and Jakar story, Genius Loci.
Is that how that's pronounced? Because I always thought it was Genus Loci.
I'm going with how I learned how to pronounce the word spelled like that in math class.
Loci is what I always thought. So.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying that's
I'm
how
saying
I
that's
right.
That's how I've always seen, you know, locus and loci, you know, the mathematical terms. That's how I've always heard it pronounced. That's how I was going to pronounce it.
Okay. That works for me.
Yeah. Loci is, at least in the free dictionary, that's how they pronounce it there.
Yeah.
Okay. In this story...
So they do give alternate pronunciations for the hard C there. So.
Oh, great. So really, we have no resolution in the end.
Yeah.
But
the Avengers will have to be out for a few more years before Loki takes over.
There you go.
Yeah, and the title is well for the story, as it's, you know, is it, you know, Genius Loci is a protective spirit of a place, so.
Right, and in this story, Londo, Leda and Jakar are off having their adventures. They're looking for a place that's a little off the beaten path in hyperspace. They come across a derelict, nearly abandoned Psi-Corps transport vessel with only one individual aboard. When they managed to find, going through the logs, the planet that the ship had last landed on was an idyllic sort of planet. When Leda and Jakar land, they find themselves walking through the thick forest. They think they've been separated. Leda sees she comes across a settlement encampment full of telepaths of various races. Jakar finds a settlement full of Narns. And Jakar sees through the illusion rather quickly, because the Narn says to the eldest Narn in the little village, tells Jakar that they're just going to wait and see what happens, and they don't have a whole lot of interest in returning to homeworld, because, you know, maybe the homeworld won't be there in some time. And of course Jakar says, well, you're not a true Narn then, because that's not how a Narn would respond, and who are you really? And of course Leda at this point in time begins to realize that the individuals in the village that she's inside of all have the exact same mental pattern, which is also sort, you know, everybody has their own little pattern, and so they both separately realize that they're dealing with one large uber mind, and it turns out to be, Neil, as you point out, the protective spirit of the place. It's the planet as a sentient being.
Which is rather an interesting concept. The planet became aware.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, to keep it secret, they're willing to kill. And basically what it does is projects a psionic impression of visitors. They're eating food. Of course, they're not eating, really. They're starving to death. And then the animals and critters drag the bodies off to decompose where it'll do the most good. And of course, Lita will have none of that, and using her heightened Vorlon senses, basically breaks the consciousness of the planet. Not quite killing it, but certainly blasting its sentience away enough that she and Jakar can escape.
She says she killed the main body of the telesymbiotic biomass.
Mm-hmm.
But she thinks that, you know, eventually it'll build back up to critical mass eventually. But it'll take centuries before it can exert enough influence.
Right.
And you have to wonder. It's like, oh, wow, Lita's a planet killer, too.
Yeah. Well, she is a Vorlon weapon.
Right. So in the PDF for that, there's this Straczynski Speaks Out piece there. Was that in the original magazine as well, or does that come from something else?
That's in the original piece. Hang on, okay. I can... Page 22. Yes, I happen to have the original magazine. At the bottom of those last two pages, it says Straczynski Speaks Out, and there's like a little corner piece at the edge of it that lists in the books that were out at the time in alphabetical order. Because if looking at this list of books, it is actually missing the Technomage. No, there's a Technomage books. There's a Centauri. No, it's got all of them. Huh. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. I thought it was missing a couple.
So
in alphabetical order by trilogy.
Aha! They are technically they are missing one. Notice how in that third line, that third one, they have The River of Souls by Yvonne Navarro, which is supposed to be coming out that December.
Right.
That book never hit shelves. And like I said, I've asked Yvonne for years to let me see the manuscript, and she won't. I'm like, please, I won't tell anyone. I will just gloat in silence. Just let me read it. Please let me read it.
Warner Brothers intend their attack on us.
So, Genus Loci, what's your takeaway from that story?
It was I thought it was an interesting problem there for the two of them, which they each solved their own way, and it was nice to see see the part of the voyages of Jakar and Lita wandering around the universe, which, as JMS says there at the end, exploring a new adventure of leading Jakar was a natural choice for him. So, and he even says the fans have expressed considerable interest in seeing what happens to leading Jakar. So, no, but what's interesting, what he says there is their story alone could be a series, frankly. So,
yeah.
Right. Some sort.
I thought it was an interesting story, but I as far as a Babylon 5 story goes, maybe I have different criteria, but I don't feel like it really – I got the feeling that you could have substituted two other characters out of any given universe and you could have still had the same story.
I don't know. I mean, we have the Psi-Cor there too.
Yeah, but you could just have, in your short story, your brain cops. I guess the thing is, it's a kind of a clever story. It's a nice little adventure story, but I don't feel like it helps to amplify the Babylon 5 universe.
Well, I mean, the one thing which seems a bit more there, you know, was, you know, when Jakar does, you know, say, you know, for every Narn, there is no greater imperative than the need to return home there. Mm-hmm. And so he is strengthening the, you know, to be a Narn, true Narn, you know, would never write off the home world, never concede even the possibility of extinction. So that's, you know, that was nicely reinforcing some of the Narn stuff in the series.
Yeah, I guess. I can see that. I just don't feel that it was as strong a...
Well, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure about that, because the way he chooses to distract the planet from Lita's psychic attack, that question, mm-hmm. you know, that's a very enlightened Jakar kind of tactic, along the same lines as put your face in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of those things where you don't see it coming when you should have.
Yeah.
Right. That, I mean, that's a very sly tactic. He's completely honest. He's completely forthright about wanting to know the answer to this question, because every life form on this planet has had the chance to think about it, and their collective brain power together came up with the answer. And then he's like, oh yeah, we came up with the, wait a minute, who's that killing me? and Jakar just sits there like, who, what, me? And that's very put your face in the book like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the basic premise of the story is JMS, you know, is harking back to, you know, whichever age you want to call it, golden or silver age plotting. But, you know, it's with these two Babylon 5 characters that we're very familiar with. And so, you know, that's the part of it. It's Babylon 5, not necessarily the actual plot.
Okay, fair enough. I also brought to mind Mogo, the Green Lantern, right, who's a planet. And I'm not saying it's a ripoff one way or the other. It was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of parallel between that and Ego and Marvel. So.
Okay, but yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was a little side story adventure, you know, as far as stories go, it was more substantial than the wordless homage we got in the Lost Tales comic. So, you know, I appreciate having a real story to read there.
Yeah, okay.
I enjoyed it. Okay. And of course,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And of course, I mean, the funny thing about what we'll be going through with all of these is, you know, I mean, JMS saying this whole thing about, you know, no, that could be a whole series. It's like, you know, yes. As
yes.
he said repeatedly recently, it's like, there is this whole universe. Just let people play in it.
Yeah.
The problem is who do we...
I know.
Yeah.
Can't help bringing it up again.
Right. I mean, even JMS just, you know, periodically releasing another short story, which is what, you know, when I read that, it was saying, yeah, I mean, you know, if he just did, you know, a few a year, that would be great.
Yeah. But, you know, at this point, it sounds like he doesn't even have the rights to play in his own universe, much less influence somebody at WB to let others play in his universe, which is kind of ironically sad. Oh, well.
So,
do you think that is really the case?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. I mean, nothing else makes sense.
Okay. So, how about Space Time of the Incurable Romantic?
That's the story that everybody wanted to read, and apparently some people, the shippers loved it, and the other B5 fans were going, what is this crap? I've never seen one short story be so loved and hated at the same time. This amuses the hell out of me.
Yeah, I mean, people wanted to see, you know, wanted Marcus to turn out alive, and then we got this.
As far as a B5 story goes, for me, it's the most successful of them because it does directly play with events that happen in the show. It deals with some very significant events, but also in some ways, like Babylon 5, it sets up a situation and demands that you draw your own conclusions from it. And I like that very much. And I have to say, I think ultimately in the end, the whole thing is really, really sick and twisted.
Yes.
I wouldn't say sick and twisted, but creepy. You know, there's a difference between sick and twisted and creepy. Sick and twisted.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Sick and twisted, right, would have been if he had, you know, come to, that had, you know, Susan be awakened at age 18.
But, you know, as Jason says on the chat, they're ethically dubious.
Yes.
Yes.
And I would. That sums it up right there. I understand Marcus's reasonings, but some of his actions I can't reconcile with who Marcus was.
Right. So,
and I think that's. Yeah, okay. for those who have not read the story.
Yeah.
Marcus is awakened when technology has reached the point where he is able to be revived because explorations of the galaxy have led Alliance worlds to find the civilization where the original machine that did the energy transfers came from. So they were able to, basically they were able to find the instruction manual.
Right. And this is 300, 350 years past the events of the series.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just like, it's not a few years down the line. It's not a couple decades. It's a significant passing of time.
Yeah. It's, They were saying he had been in cryostasis for over, I think it was 300 and 350 years.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. So it would have been 300 years since Ivanova passed. Is what it was. So he was awakened, and he was wondering, you know, why she wasn't there. And you're like, well, no, she's dead. It's been, you know, 300 years. And so he's revived. He's caught up on everything, but he's still alone. He doesn't want to go join the Rangers, start training again. He doesn't want to engage in the world again. He's still emotionally and mentally stuck 300 years in the past.
Right, yeah.
And then he hears from a, I don't know, an acolyte, a Minbari acolyte, would you say? Have you heard her voice? And he's like, what? And he learns that there's other new technologies that have been able to preserve people's thoughts and neural patterns after they die. And I have a problem with this in a second, but I'll get back to it. So Marcus decides to, for lack of a better word, steal Ivanova's essence from an archive where academics have been coming to hear her speak, you know, to hear her thoughts of what was going on. So basically he's stealing, you know, precious research material.
Well, okay, and, go ahead. I was going to delve into detail, but keep going with the synopsis.
Yeah, so he you know, managing to rue his way through the underground, he steals the crystals that contain the matrix that makes up Susan's, for lack of a better word, brain patterns, memories.
Right.
He takes the rest of his fortune and goes to another planet with a bit of her DNA and has that person grow a new Susan with, you know, from scratch, grow a new Susan and, oh, put these memories in here, but stop at this date right here. And then he puts himself back in cryostasis for the 32 years it takes to grow the new Susan. So he comes out of cryostasis, picks up the new Susan, lands on a planet that's all their own, and decides to live happily ever after with her.
Well, he makes it, the way he destroys the ship, the story he tells her when she's revived, he tells her that basically it's just after they've won the Shadow War and their ship right. was attacked by raiders on their way back to B5, and it's crashed, it's wrecked, they're way off the beaten path, and it's not likely that they'll ever find rescue ever again.
Yeah, no distress signal was able to go out.
Right. He basically lies through his teeth to her.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's a successful story because it really does stop and make you think and wonder mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. But yeah, ethically dubious, I think, is an understatement.
Right, and he's praying that she doesn't remember that he died and
she died, he died to save her, right. and then because that right. would make everything just all sorts of weird.
Right. she's saying that she has this feeling of sitting and talking to you and him not listening. So
yes, and he plays that off. Oh, when have I ever listened to you? Oh, good point. Ha ha ha. I'm not saying that as to dismiss it. It's just like that's you know. And Marcus breathes a sigh of relief because he's dodged the bullet. He doesn't have to explain really what's going on. And here's the other part of it, though, is now having read all this where Marcus, while he was in suspended animation, one of the things that Susan did was to set up a trust fund for him. So that's where he gets all his money. It's basically all his money that's been gathering interest over 300 odd years or whatever. So he's got those funds taken care of. So he's spending all this to revive her, and we're sitting here going, well –
yeah, sorry, I think the Analyst Shock set it up 200 years ago, so it's been so it was after Ivana actually passed away.
But the point I'm trying to make is we are deriding Marcus for the choices he makes in the story, having been revived into a world that may not be significantly different than what he's used to. You know, not enough detail is given, but the fact of the matter is he does feel like he doesn't have a place in this world.
Oh.
It calls into question Susan's motivations to begin with, all the way back.
Yeah, why keep those are my questions. Why keep Marcus alive past her own death? And why did Marcus not even try to engage in this new world? If he had tried to engage in the new world and failed, I might be able to see that as a way to reach back and hold on. I would feel more comfortable with the justifications. But he didn't even try.
Right.
Didn't see any attempt. If he had tried to re-enter the world, as an Amleshock teacher, as a historian, as anything. It just tried it and it didn't feel right. He just was like, I don't belong here. This is wrong. Then I would have been more comfortable with him retreating into the past. And the other thing that I'm curious about. Thank you, Jason.
What does he say?
I think you're giving Marcus way too much normalcy credit. Dude was a weirdo.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's exactly what I'm thinking too. Here's the other part of it is he doesn't have time to process the grief to wake up and know, you know, because part of what is said in the story is that this wasn't how it was supposed to be. He was supposed to sacrifice his life for her, and then she does her best to try to keep him alive in stasis, and then she's dead. And so he's not in a place where he can't process the grief. He doesn't process the grief. And as we've seen through the series, that's not his thing. He doesn't want it. That's why he joins the Rangers in the first place, because it's out of this misplaced sense of guilt for the death of his brother. And so I don't have a problem believing that the first thing he would do is, hey, I'm going to build me my own Susan Ivanova. You know,
Susan 2.0,
right? Complete with all the modesty that he feels about her, because when he goes to there's no other way to say it, when he goes to pick up the body, there she is floating in the tank, stark.
He turns away,
naked.
Right? Yeah, tells the mad scientist who's grown her, could you send her out in clothes? And this guy's like, okay, but
yeah.
No, and that's the other thing. You know, he's contacted a guy through the black market, mm-hmm. through criminal means, to find someone who can actually do this. Mm-hmm. And the scientist tells him, look, what you're asking for is patently illegal.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing. It's like the guy's like, hey, you had me grow you a girlfriend. Why do I think you want her to have clothes?
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of creepy. Again, with the creepy. Anyway, but go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, when I first read this story, I mean, to me, it just perfectly fit in with all of the oddity that was Marcus. I mean, as Jason Carter so famously opined on this show. It's when he discovered, what do you mean he's a virgin?
Right, right.
So this means he's been a virgin for 400. So he's a virgin for 400 years now.
Yes, the 400-year-old virgin.
So when it's going to happen, it's going to happen right, damn it.
Right, and that's the other thing. It's not, even at the end of the story, he's not like coming on to her like, we're going to be Adam and Eve on this abandoned planet. It's all about doing the chivalrous thing. I mean, it is really, it's really weird and creepy and all the rest. And I think from that standpoint, I think JMS, I don't think he necessarily was intentionally trying to tweak noses of people, but I think he, I can't help but wonder if it wasn't, okay, you wanted to know what happens to Marcus. Here you go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. Come on. All right. If you read this story 5 years after you read it the first time and you've watched the series a couple more times, this was definitely the bored 12-year-old at the family picnic who discovers the hornet's nest and goes, whack!
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. But my like I said earlier, when they were talking about the stored neural matrix for all these different historical people.
Yep.
My first question was, how did the Minbari see that as being different from the soul hunters collecting souls and talking to them in the dark of night?
Thank you.
I don't know. I think it would be a pale imitation of the true soul.
It's damn close, but yet the Minbari are cool with it.
They're copies. Yeah. They're copies.
Huh? So anyway, JMS has a post talking about the split views on the episode on the story there, and he says, on the one side you have those who think it's a very romantic story with a happy ending, which is totally the right response, and then on the other side you've you've got those who think it's a morally dubious story, or even worse, which is also totally the right response. Yes, it becomes a question of what you, the reader, thinks is appropriate and where the priorities are. Does Marcus, having laid down his life and suffered and lost everything and everyone he holds dear, deserve a last shot at happiness using a technology that is probably being used by other people for far worse purposes? On the other hand, the technology and the invasiveness of it raises very real questions and concerns. One can say it's an invasion, but is it really? Is it her, or is it a blank slate? What makes her her? If in the end he is happy at last and she is happy, who are we to question? But should we not question the thrust of the technology and the uses it might be put to in future? I knew it would drive a wedge right down the middle of the readers, and that's exactly why it was written, to pose questions and raise issues for heated discussion, because what's right or wrong here is a matter of perspective, as it should be. Anyway, he wrote that July 9th, 2000.
Now, there's two other things that, again, the little tangents in my brain as I was reading through this. The first that came to mind is the end of the classic Star Trek episode Metamorphosis with Zefram Cochrane and Commissioner Hedford, who's been melded with a companion, and that they're going to stay on this little idyllic world, grow old together, live out their years, and of course stalwart Captain Kirk says, okay, we're not going to tell anybody you're here. The other thing that it made me think of was the end to Spielberg's AI, where I don't know how familiar you are with the movie. I love that movie, by the way. But at the very end of it, the aliens who have come to Earth to sort of examine this fallen civilization, they find our little boy hero, robot hero, and they ask him, well, can we do anything for you? And he goes, revive my mom. And he's got a locket of her hair. And they said, well, she's only going to be alive for a day. And he says, that's okay. That's one day I get with her. You know?
Right,
but at the end, she's obviously dying. And he says, I'm going to be with you forever. So that's – get this image of this little android robot with this decaying corpse. And I can't help but feel the same way – reading about Marcus on this whole thing that he's engineered because he thinks it's what's going to make him happy.
Right.
I don't know. It's all unsettling. It's just very unsettling to me.
One little treat in the story is that we've got a Garibaldi in the story. You know, related to Michael Garibaldi back 5-6 generations.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people in Marsdome who can claim that relationship.
Yeah. But still.
I like that. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
Edmund, you were about to say something.
Yeah, no, to my mind, I mean, the wonderful thing about this story is that it is sort of, you know, it is, you know, as JM has said, it's like, no, you can read it in the various ways. And, my fevered brain, you know, will tend towards the creepy. But introducing that technology and, you know, and because it's something that actually in the series, they didn't actually dwell on that much. And okay, it's 300 years in the future. But I mean, it certainly sounds like something, you know, they were pretty close to doing in the series. That's what I've always really liked about this story is that, there's part of you that, you know, sort of as the fan of the show, you're going like, yeah, they finally get together. And then it's like, ooh, wait a minute. No, this just doesn't quite feel right. In terms of sort of, you know, that dual, you know, yes, on the surface it's fine, but then you start thinking about the implications and it just starts getting, you know, really sort of sleazy and creepy. And I just thought it was wonderful how they managed to meld both of those together.
All right, any final thoughts on Space-Time and Incurable Romantic?
Yep.
What's our next story?
Our next story comes from Babylon 5 magazine, number 22, from May of 2000. Hidden Agendas, also written by J. Michael Straczynski.
Right. And on the, at the beginning, before the story starts, it says the readership voted from a list of four areas suggested by JMS, and the overall winner was the old Babylon 5 crew during the five-year arc. So sit back and enjoy.
All right. Well, Neil, give us a quick plot synopsis.
So it starts off with Susan Ivanova's on her, on the Titans, one of the first Warlock class destroyers, and she's feeling a bit weird about her ship. And she comes to Babylon 5. She gets Sheridan to get on a shuttle and get on the ship, and she doesn't tell him what's going on, and she wants to see what reaction he has, and his reaction is that there's shadow tech on the ship. And so he goes back, and he's trying to he's talking with her, and they talk with Lockley about trying, what are they going to do about it. That Ivanova has this shadow tech ship, which could turn on her at any time. So they enlist Lita's help with trying to deal with what's going on. And so combination with Lita, and also there's the original part of Kasha's ship, I think it is, either Kasha or Yulkis' ship, which was regrown on Babylon 5, and using the two, both that and Lita's powers, they managed to extinguish the shadow part of the Titan ship. And so they know at the end that at least if something happens to all of these Warlock class ships, Lisa Ivanova can fight back with her own ship.
Okay. So this obviously takes place between, I guess, the fourth and the fifth seasons.
I mean, it is sometime in the fifth season. It might even have some time stamp of how long Lockley had been there. I can't remember. So it's early in the fifth season, I would think.
Gotcha. And how do you feel how Lockley was portrayed in the story? Does it capture the tone of her character, give you a better sense of the character that she is or would become?
I thought she was portrayed pretty well. I mean, of course, it is JMS writing it, so he has his characters. He knows what his characters are going to say.
All right. I don't know. Anybody have anything else to say about this one? Doesn't sound like it's a particularly moving story, not in the same way that Space-Time Incurable Romantic was.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't anything all too controversial, but it was nice. I mean, key thing, seeing Ivanova having, moved on beyond what we had already seen in the past,
right?
Was nice. Mm-hmm. Nice there. So, and I think it was relatively short, but it was it was interesting to see the whole thing, and then what's going on with these Warlock class ships and Bay 13 on on Babylon 5.
What do you think of calling Lita in to use as a focus for the Vorlon ship to come in and erase whatever was in there, or I guess an anchor point would be more.
It was a good use of what she can do, and of course her connection with the Vorlons there, and so there is some drama there with it seeming that the ship's going to tear itself apart there, and so casting back to in the series of the two, Kasha's and old Kesha's ships fighting each other.
Jason says Hidden Agendas goes in between Long Night of Londa Millar and Paragon of Animals.
So we still have Alita who is willing to be helpful.
Yeah.
And not quite at the point where she's feeling put upon.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, there's a part here that she's, Byron is on the station, and she's thinking that maybe she should go see what he has to say. So she hasn't done that yet.
Okay. Yeah, because I'll admit I have not read it, but the moment I heard that, it's like, well, okay, it couldn't be too late into season 5.
Right, yeah. Right. So, yeah, perhaps she would stop by one of Byron's talks, if not this week, then the next. No rush, after all. She'd just go and listen.
Yeah.
She wouldn't madly fall in love.
Yes, right.
Wait, I don't remember that last line in there.
I think there's something also about being naked, too, but I don't know. All right. Any further comments on Hidden Agendas?
I think that's good. We can move on to True Seeker in issue number 23.
And that's written by Fiona Avery.
Right.
That is correct.
So this stars, Elisa Belden, who we saw back in the first season as the young girl who all the races were vying for her telepathic powers and maturity, and she was, went to Minbari, and so she's been named a True Seeker by the Minbari, and right now she is helping a young Narn trying to find where she came from and her heritage and just who she was. And so she and the Narn Jerrica is her name are there, and Elisa senses danger among them, and so she goes and hides away from the Narn there. And then eventually they try and find Natoth. And once and Elisa entrusts Natoth with Jerrica's safety while she goes off to try and get proof of just who Jerrica actually is and why people are interested in her. And so she goes to a database and pulls out Jerrica's genetic files, and while she's doing that, she senses people saying that she must not survive the night. Can't believe the Kari already know about this, and so she knows that Jerrica is the daughter of some high-ranking member of the Kari, and Elisa then listens in, and she finds out that these Narn think that Jerrica is in some bar, and so she's extremely upset about that Natoth has let her out, and then so she gets to the bar, and there's a confrontation at the bar between these Narn and Natoth and Elisa then the Narn Narn guards come and lock them up, which seems to be a there's no sweat on the Narn about this, about being this. And then Elisa tries and wants to present the case in a trial by the Kari of trying to give Jerrica her rights as possibly a member on the Kari itself. But then the circle thinks that Jerrica has been corrupted by her staying on Earth all this time, and then Natoth says that she is Narn. Look at her; she's the same as you and I. And I'm here to support Jakar in this, and believe he would want his own heir and daughter to take his place. So it has been turned that she is the daughter of Jakar. And then Jakar shows up, the council goes away, and there's a nice bit of Elisa thinking that she's wondering if their decision-making was akin to 12 angry Narn. Mm-hmm. And then they come back, and Jakar basically says that there's one choice, that they can take her, or he can take Jerrica away with him. And he'll never return, so they'll be without his advice. So basically, they take the case that Jericho's going to take Jakar's place at the Karifer Circle. It is law that my closest here take the seat. It is tradition, and either that or they leave Narn, and so that is the case that she's going to take his place, and she has already started writing while she was imprisoned, and Natoth sees that similarity in character with Jakar there, and at the end, Jerrica and Jakar are fully united, and that's the end of the story. So it was, it's an interesting look at the at Narn after these years, after the free Narn here, of how it has been changed. Natoth is a bit upset that the Minbari have come and put in air filters and made the clouds give a daily rain on the planet to try and make it more habitable, and it's for her it's a bit annoying that they've done this without asking them.
Typical Narn.
Yeah,
it has to be harder. It's not worth going. Not worth doing.
So it was nice bit of Narn, and it was nice to see Lisa Belden. What has happened to her since we last saw her, and she's doing. She still has that business. That she was when we saw her. A bit of a thief, and she does things that Minbari wouldn't be doing there. But she's not in Minbari, so she steals the data crystal, manipulates the mind of some of the Narn there, and but she's doing all this for the best of motives.
Right. I think it's very interesting to choose characters who would be considered secondary and tertiary in the Babylon 5 universe.
Right. Jakar basically just has about four columns worth of a magazine that he's in there. So he it's more of a guest appearance there.
But, gotcha. Oh yeah.
All right. Any other thoughts?
With Jakar, it's almost like a deus ex deus, but. And Jakar appears at the end. It's like, we haven't seen you for 6 years. No. And he corrects them to 7 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. But that absence did have a certain effect, and Jakar has to come back to correct some things then.
Right. So that reinforces the time. So he has gone off, voyaged with Leda, and now, he's back here.
All right. Any further comments on this story?
Summer?
Not I. I just enjoyed seeing another Narn fight. A Narn bar fight. Come on.
Yeah.
What's not to love?
Right.
I'd love to see the Narn versus Drazi. All right, I must be the only one. All right, what's our next story?
No, I'm thinking, I'm running that over my head, because that's a lot of hard heads hitting each other. That's
I don't think that's going to end well for anyone.
Nah. Okay. The next story is in
magazine number 24, the final issue of Babylon 5 magazine.
The very, very last one. The Nautilus Coil by Greg Keyes.
Author of the Cyclocore trilogy.
Yeah. And it's a little coda to it. And does Edwin want to summarize this?
I think he does.
Sure. Yes, I do. Yeah, this is basically where we have Michael Garibaldi and Lita teamed up again. And they are off to investigate something that Lita knows about. And Garibaldi is itching to know about, of course, but she has come to him for a little bit of help, because she has to get to a far-off spot in space that happens to be in the former Vorlon space. And, of course, her hook is that she thinks that, you know, this is all in the period before, you know, I would guess at the tail end of the telepath conflict, where she suspects that Bester has gotten hold of his information and is already off on his way to it. And that's basically the hook to get Garibaldi to, you know, to take her along to this space. And, of course, after a little bit of jousting, they do head off on the voyage and get to this abandoned planet that seems to be completely blasted. There seems to be evidence that the Psi-Corps shuttle had gotten there first, but has been destroyed on the planet. And the two of them, go down to investigate, and or actually go in to investigate, I should say, and discover, to everyone's astonishment, that Kevin Vassett, the first leader of the Psi-Corps, is actually on the planet. This, I mean, actually, now that I think about it, to a certain extent, kind of resembles, you know, what the original Star Trek series, All My Yesterdays, where he's, you know, he's like sort of the, you know, the broken old man who then starts telling them all the stories of what happened there. But basically, it's Kevin Vassett explaining that, you know, no, this, all of that experimentation the Vorlons were doing on developing telepathy and all the races, this is where it all happened. And they had made the discovery that, you know, if, you know, that either you can evolve naturally and, you know, develop all the instincts that allow you to survive, you know, or you can become a telepath and just tell everybody what you want to happen, but they can't happen independently. So that's, you know, why they wound up introducing telepathy the way they did, because they had to allow the races to evolve naturally and then insert the telepathic gene. And this was their basically hideous little laboratory where they had evolved all of these various species to their telepathic potential, and then extracted the genes and distributed them throughout the universe. So they basically hear all this and then get ambushed by the Psi-Corps cadre that was in fact already there, and have a big gunfight, and Lita's injured, and Bassett is of course fatally injured, and they manage to escape and get away from the planet, at which point we switch back to the planet to discover that after they have conveniently mentioned earlier in the story that, you know, we're reminding those who are not as conversant with Babylon 5 as we are that telepaths can create illusions in people's minds, you cut back to the planet to discover Mr. Vassett has basically constructed that entire shootout to get everybody off of their backs, while he basically prepares the telepaths to expand into, I presume, Vorlon space and, well, you know, wherever he thinks they should move into. The one part I was leaving out deliberately was, you know, just finally reminding everybody that, you know, yes, he did have a little piece of Vorlon inserted into him, just like Sheridan did. In his case, it came from his mother. Which is that, you know, a little piece of the Psi-Corps trilogy that is in there, but, you know, but is quite underplayed. Yep. It's the reason why he was able to pretend he was a mundane, you know, for so long, you know, pretend he was a mundane while he was really a telepath. and you know, basically establish that, you know, yes, you know, as powerful as we may think Leta was, that, you know, Bassett is part Vorlon and is even more powerful, and you're just sort of left with this. I'm not quite sure if it's in the ominous sense, because it's, you know, there's kind of this sense at the end of, you know, no, I mean, the, you know, it's not they want to defeat the mundane, you know, it's like, no, there's this whole vast universe that they can expand into and do what they want with, and, you know, they're kind of leaving us behind at the end.
Right, right.
That in a nutshell is the summary.
Yeah, it's a little disturbing in there, but you know, just it was sort of forecast earlier in there with you know, the reference to what happened in the when I guess it was Through Dark Places was mentioned what Talia had done had been mentioned, and we see this here. So though there's one thing which I guess reading this and the Genius Loci so close to one another, you know, they both have this, you know, they're in a ship there, arriving there, and there's a Psycor ship which has met some bad end right there. So, you know, two stories written close to one another with that same aspect to it.
Very interesting. And where in the, I guess, where in the Babylon 5 timeline does the story fall? It's obviously before the Telepath War, because he's alive, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, now that found a little bit hard to pinpoint. I mean, it's Leta and Garibaldi. The other aspect of this was, you know, the Garibaldi still has the mind block at the beginning of the story, and then Leta removes it during the story. And the fact that Bester is still, is obviously still a threat. I mean, the fact that they're basically saying, I placed it more, you know, sort of, you know, within or perhaps towards the end of the war, because, you know, there's that sense of, you know, no, you know, we you know, if Bester gets this, he's going to wipe us all out. So there's, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, no, you know, this is a tale of, you know, within the Telepath War or Crisis or Civil War, whatever you want to call it.
Gotcha.
You know, I've always had trouble calling it the Telepath War, given, you know, what little has come out in the novel.
Right. Yeah. At least one review places it 2 or 3 years after the end of season 5, but before the end of the Telepath Crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be before the end of the Telepath War. They're still worried about Bester and what he's going to do with it. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, Jason is saying 2265.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, yeah, I mean, this is long before Bester's on the run, obviously. And, you know, they're still worried about what he
now,
might
and
do.
It,
so.
In terms of tone, how does it fit in with the Psycor trilogy? Do you get a sense that that is also, I mean, how much of is Aki's voice coming through? How much of it does it feel like it's an extension of that trilogy?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good melding, because, I mean, no, I mean, certainly with the Kevin Bassett stuff, I mean, rings very true, but of course, I mean, he was the one who, you know, wrote basically all of the Bassett stuff previously, but even in terms of the Leta Garibaldi back and forth in the beginning of, you know, the first half of the story. It still meshed with what was going on in the Babylon 5 universe.
Gotcha. Any other thoughts?
No, I agree with you know, it's a nice little coda there to the Psycor trilogy, you know, fitting in there, seeing, you know, more of what happened to Mr. Bassett there.
Just in terms of it being a continuation, I mean, the use of
the long spaceship and the relativistic time. I mean, when I first read it, I mean, it was one of those things where, as I, you know, even they were giving the time frames, you know, and I'm, you know, reading science fiction since I was five, so, you know, even as they were going through all that, and then it was like, you know, no, when they got there, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, yes, of course, it could be him on that spaceship. So, you know, I thought that was rather nicely done, you know, especially, you know, when, you know, you're reading a Babylon 5 story, so you're already thinking about jump cakes, et cetera, and then he throws in that little twist of, you know, no, a slower spaceship.
right.
Just brings it all together at the end.
You get to travel in the future if you go but relativistic speeds.
Exactly.
All right, guys, now here comes the tough question. In terms of overall rating, what do you think is the most successful story out of this batch?
In
terms of controversy, we know which one. But.
Yeah, well, but yeah. But you know, set that part of it aside.
What's your criteria for best story? The one that gets the best feel of the Babylon 5 universe, the one that gets the best feel of the characters, or the one that's actually the best tale?
Well, I'm asking the question. How do you define it?
Great. I think I like the True Seeker story for the way it captures the Narn's post-Centauri occupation raison d'etre. They're trying to reestablish themselves, but they still, as Jakar pointed out, they still don't know who they are yet. They haven't recaptured who they really are in trying to, don't know what the best way to put it. They're still acting like little kids. As Jakar said, you know, he's like, you want me to be your advisor, but you're not listening to me, so shut up. I think the Londo story also touches on the pain and self-sacrifice that Londo has come to accept as his burden in life. And even though he knows there's not going to be a real respite from it the rest of his life, he does what he can to make sure it doesn't touch any innocence that he can help along the way. So, and I guess in terms of the feel of the Babylon 5 universe, those two are the closest. In terms of revealing some more backstory that we didn't know about, the Londo story and the Vassad story. I mean, the telepaths, we get little tidbits here of, and it just makes us want more. It really does. It just makes us want more, damn it. So that's what I got.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, it was great to, you know, I got the B5 magazines, and it was great to have these extra tastes there, but... And I just wish we had more. So it was good just now to you know, finally see the Amazing Stories ones and enjoy those.
Edmund, how about you? Where do you rank the story?
Yeah, I mean for me, I think it's more in terms of the ones that fill in the gaps we haven't had. I mean, it would be Genius Loci, because, you know, let's face it, everybody is always wondered about, you know, what adventures Jakar and Leeta had. And, of course, the Nautilus Coil. I mean, just because, you know, the big gaping hole that he kept, you know, open there for future development, which, you know, we are increasingly, feeling is not going to happen. You know, it, you know, is the rest of the telepath crisis been filling in that period between the end of B5 and the beginning of Crusade? So, you know, at least having, you know, a little piece to that was great. But, you know, we are still waiting for, you know, whatever negotiations or, you know,
rune gathering or sacrifice making has to happen for that to actually occur.
Gotcha. Now, would you say overall that these are stories that are well worth seeking out, or is this something that, you know, as a general fan, nice to know, but doesn't necessarily detract from your enjoyment for the main event, which is, of course, the series?
No, I would say they're well worth seeking out.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, I gotcha. Mean, you know, I mean, they certainly don't detract from the series. I mean, it's more, you know, that's one thing about the way JMS did this was, you know, and everything that came out was filling in other aspects. So, you know, no, I mean, I don't see any reason not to find them and read them. And, I don't think they in any way diminish, you know, the series as a whole. So.
All right, then. Well, I think it's, I think at that point, why don't we go ahead and just wrap it up?
Yep.
That's your job, Summer, because you're here.
I know. I'm not going to be Summer
this time.
I'm trying to catch up on a few things here. If you have any questions or comments on these stories, be sure to leave comments on this particular post. If you want to start arguments about which short stories were better than others, that website is BabylonPodcast.com. You can also email those comments to BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. Yep. We do have a forums over there somewhere, farpointforums.com. Not sure. I think we lost like 2 years worth of threads because of the server crash that Scott's ISP had, but so be it. We can move on, continue from there. And as always, call in your voice. Yes, we can rebuild it. They will come. Call in the voicemail line and leave your comments. We are going to have a feedback-a-palooza real soon, aren't we?
Yes.
And that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Spanish Galleon.